This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The worst thing that could happen is if workers feel that they have to fight each other for the jobs, because then the corporations are sitting back and they're the ones that benefit.
Canadian and U.S. auto workers speak out about the growing trade war and tariffs that the Trump government is imposing on Canada and Mexico.
How many people out there know that there is a man that confessed to actually doing the shooting of Faulkner? How many people know about that? How many people understand and have the information that who was involved in the frame-up of Mumia, because it is a frame-up?
Former attorney for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rachel Wilkerstein, discusses Jamal's innocence and his unjust 44-year imprisonment in the U.S.
And in terms of standing firm, you can't have a better example of standing firm than Andre McLaughlin. She was that.
We honor the life and contributions of the late scholar activist Dr. Andre Nicola McLaughlin, who was a Dr. Betty Shabazz Distinguished Chair for Social Justice at Megar Evers College and founder of the International Black Women's Cross-Cultural Institute.
The 30-year war in Congo never would have happened if there weren't willing buyers for all the stolen minerals.
Pacifica's Anne Garrison responds to podcaster Mario Nafal's interview with Rwandan President Paul Kagame. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I am your host, Akua Holt. President Trump's imposition of a 25% tariff on Canadian and Mexican imports has created havoc and a crisis for working people, particularly for auto workers in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer talked with Michigan UAW 160 GM auto worker Jesse Kelly, Canadian GM Unifor Local 222 member Tony Lee, and Detroit GM UAW 909, former President Frank Hammer, about the trade war tariffs and its impact on working people.
So, Tony, you're in Canada, you're at a GM plant. How is this affecting workers in Canada, and what does it mean for Canadian workers as far as this tariff imposition by the Trump administration?
Well, the first thing is that it's created unbelievable anxiety amongst workers, uncertainty about what's going to happen. The expectation has been floated around by quite a few people that if the tariffs had been implemented, that plants would have been shut within a week. The supply chain would have been disrupted. But it's also absolutely clear that a 25% tariff on export of vehicles would mean that a pickup truck built in Oshawa would be hit with a probably $15,000 tariff to go across the border to the United States. And that wasn't going to happen. GM's not going to pay that. They're going to shut down before they do that. So it really has hit workers hard. They want to resist. They want to fight back. But I think it's also created a lot of uncertainty about how to go about that, because the immediate reaction people feel is they want to defend their jobs. And the worst thing that could happen is if workers feel that they have to fight each other for the jobs, because then the corporations are sitting back and they're the ones that benefit.
Jesse, what's been the effect in General Motors in your plant?
Yeah, so I think right now we haven't even seen the full consequences of these actions yet. And so my fear is that although we're not seeing it right now, we're going to see a lot of unintended consequences, even though I do believe that this is a game of chicken. And it's hard for me to understand how long they plan on doing this, if they do this at all. But there will always be unintended consequences. And those are going to look like really hurting the working class altogether. One of the biggest consequences I think we're going to see on the immediate end, to Tony's point, is just the breakdown in solidarity across borders with workers just like us. And we need to rely on those workers in order for us to even get good contracts at home, because unless you liberate the whole entire working class, these companies are always going to find ways to exploit each other and to pit us against each other to end up the victor in the end. So that's going to be, I think, the most immediate and the most devastating consequence on the front end of this. And then I think on the back end of this, we're just going to see just a lot of hostility, car prices raise that will go down to the consumers. I think that there's going to be so much uncertainty with these markets that the companies are just automatically going to be looking for places to go where they're going to be able to exploit workers with lower tariffs that aren't the US, aren't Mexico, and aren't Canada. And I think that that will hurt us all too. I mean, it's an unfortunate reality. I think we have a lot of political education to do around a lot of different topics, especially in the UAW. The most devastating to me is that our own international union came out in a statement in support of these tariffs. And I think it's because for so long, NAFTA has been used as a means to weaponize workers against each other. And when you're really short-sighted, and when you don't understand that when you're dealing with global companies, if you don't have global solidarity, if you're not fighting this globally, you'll always lose. So the short-sighted vision of this is to be mad, you know, at NAFTA and to then allow this division to occur with workers in these other countries and these, you know, invisible borders. And I think that we have a very, very short-sighted vision right now. And I was very upset with that statement. I know a lot of workers were upset and a lot of workers were happy with that statement. They do naturally believe that tariffs are going to be the answer to save their jobs. And it's really unfortunate because I don't believe that that's the answer. I think these companies will continue to exploit wherever they can. Short-sighted, not well thought out tariffs without the goal of liberating the middle class will never be successful.
And the USMCA was negotiated, in fact, by Trump, saying it was a great victory for workers. Frank, what happened? Why is all of a sudden Trump now saying that he's going to dump the USMCA and institute tariffs against Canada and Mexico?
I just want to remind people, and I want to take them back to when the USMCA was negotiated. And this was Trump's supposed trumping the NAFTA, right? And he said at the time, I will say that we just ended a nightmare known as NAFTA. They took our jobs for a long time. And we now have a brand new US-Mexico-Canada agreement. It's a whole different ballgame. And it's going to be great for this plant. He was talking at a Dana manufacturing facility. It's going to be incredible for Michigan and for every place, everywhere else in our country. The USMCA is the fairest, most balanced, and beneficial trade agreement we've ever signed into law. I mean, this is the rhetoric that was wrapped around that trade agreement. And you can see now that Trump is going to, whatever he does with the tariffs, he's going to wrap the same wrap around this rotten, to the core agreement that will fool, unfortunately, some of the auto workers. But I think that it's time for auto workers to realize that he's just sugarcoating doing something on behalf of the capitalist class. And he's trying to sell it in a way that he sold the USMCA, and all of a sudden the USMCA, well, it's not so good anymore. Oh, well, what are we going to do now? So I think that I'm in agreement with Jesse and Tony that the UAW and the labor movement as a whole has got to completely take a different orientation to what's being promoted, certainly by the Trump's reactionary folks in the White House and in the Congress.
And the United States believes it can't compete with China with automobiles, as well as Europe can't compete with China. China is the largest producer of automobiles, EV vehicles. This trade war isn't part of a global crisis of capitalism. I mean, where companies and countries fight each other for survival. That's really what's going on.
I think that you're right, that what we really have to look at, I think, is what is going to strengthen workers and what is going to strengthen the corporations that we're battling with. If we think that we have common interests with corporations, we're clearly not going to get anywhere. They have the upper hand. And this kind of a trade war mentality is strengthening the hands of the corporations. And what's missing is any actions that are being taken by the labor movement to strengthen our relationship with other workers internationally.
Sometimes when we talk about the consequences of an action, we're not even fully sure the consequences of the action until so many years later. And, you know, these little tiny things that you see happen in like the Republican Party or the Democratic Party has unintended consequences. And I would say that Trump is a, you know, unintended consequence of the Democratic Party not sticking up for the working class 3-4 decades ago. In fact, that was like my immediate, you know, thought and response when I was reading the UAW statement was it's just so wild to me to believe that this is going to somehow, you know, uplift the working class when this is being directed by the ultra wealthy. And it, trust me, Elon Musk and Trump are not sitting in their office figuring out how to make more good working class jobs. They're in their office trying to figure out how they can rein in more power through this chaos and through this confusion, and how, you know, them and their ultra wealthy friends can capitalize off of this more and more. Like, this has nothing to do with us. We're going to suffer for every single decision that's being made right now. And he's even telling people, I mean, Trump is actively saying, you know, like, people are going to have to take the sacrifices now. And what it will lead to is more American jobs. So I guess my question to like the American people is, if you're going to suffer for the next 3 years, wouldn't you like to suffer in a way that you know at the end of the day is going to benefit you, not suffer for 3 years and then still be enslaved to corporations and still be enslaved to the ultra wealthy to live paycheck to paycheck? I would just rather make the next 3 years of sacrifice look like exactly what Tony's saying, where, you know, we seize the means of control. We have more say as the working class over our jobs, over where these products are being built, over what that looks like for us, or over where investments go. I would much rather, you know, suffer with that end goal than to suffer with, you know, either the same or worse than what we have right now. And that's where we're going.
Well, wouldn't that require, though, a kind of a political revolution? I mean, because both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, are controlled by these same billionaires who really benefit or, you know, from getting rid of workers, like with AI. I mean, unregulated, the introduction of AI is being brought in to get rid of workers to make more profits. Isn't that really what's driving all this investment in AI, is to get rid of workers so they can increase their profit rate?
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, technology as a whole, I mean, AI is a giant part of that, but technology in a whole, before we had AI, we had robots taking, you know, factory jobs. And until everybody starts benefiting from the advancements in technology in this society, we're just going to continue to widen the gap between the people that are forced out of that and the people that benefit from that. And that's why we are seeing this just, you know, this large, large gap, and we have billionaires compared to people that can't even afford to eat or can't afford their rent. And that's just going to get wider and wider until we all together, because there's more of us than there is of them, come together collectively and we say, we're all going to start advancing from these kinds of things. And, you know, we're going to resist and we're going to organize and we're going to, you know, even come up with like a whole nother working class party until we get what we need. And yeah, I think that will ultimately have to be the answer. And I hope people realize that and take steps towards that.
That was specific as Steve Zeltzer is speaking with Canadian and U.S. auto workers on how Trump tariffs on Canada and Mexico imports are impacting auto workers.
The bully boy with the big toys makes a big noise. He wants everyone to bow down. I'm gonna tell it like it is, 'cause I'm pissed now. And I know how he hungers for a crown. Divide and conquer, that's his plan. A storm of tweets, an endless scam. He's delusional, confusional, bam, bam. And he's crazy at the wheel. So out of touch, doesn't know what's real. He's got a heart that just can't feel. He's crazy at the wheel.
New music by Moss Henry, Crazy Man at the Wheel. This is Specifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Former attorney for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rachel Wilkestein, sat down with Block Report Radio's J.R. Valray to discuss Jamal's innocence and his unjust 44-year imprisonment in the U.S.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has been a political prisoner. This is going on 44 years. What does it mean when people say that Mumia is a political prisoner? And what does it mean when we say he's innocent?
Well, that's a big question. I want to start by saying that Mumia has been political since the time he was 15 years old. And there's an FBI report that was written about him that placed him on the COINTELPRO hit list of people who should be locked up if there's any social disturbance in the country. And at that point, I'm quoting from an FBI document, which says that in spite of Mumia as the subject's age, 15 years old, the Philadelphia FBI feels that his continued participation in BPP activities, Black Panther Party, as you know, in the Philadelphia area, his position in the Philadelphia branch as the Lieutenant Minister of Information for the BPP, and his past inclination to appear and speak at public gatherings, the subject should be included on the security index. So here's a clear statement from the FBI that is part of their files and their attempt to actually, you know, incarcerate Mumia, target him for execution, which is what the COINTELPRO objective was by the FBI, you know, which came out, Hoover came out at that point, FBI Director Edgar Hoover, saying the Negro youth and moderates have been made to understand that if they succumb to revolutionary teachings, they will be dead revolutionaries. And that has been the target on Mumia's back from the time he was 15 years old. So people use the term a lot about weaponization and what's being weaponized. Well, the entire U.S. Investigative agencies, federal and state, as well as the courts, targeted Mumia, weaponized the whole legal system to see Mumia locked up for life, if not executed. And so that's who he is. And it was, just as you said, for being a young member of the Black Panther Party, and then somewhat later as a journalist, as a outspoken defender of the MOVE organization, and recognized as somebody who was not going to at all bend to the pressures of society of saying he should be acting a particular way, even cut his hair. And he was at one point, right about the time that he was arrested, within a year or so before he was arrested falsely for the murder of police officer Faulkner, he was sought by all his colleagues in Philadelphia, not only black journalists there. Mumia was the head of the Black Journalists Association at that time. But that Mumia was going to be the first black man to actually be a TV newscaster, and that he was going to be, you know, one of those people who was going to be in the forefront of this type of breakthrough. Mumia was offered positions, and he wouldn't cut his hair. They wanted to cut his hair, change his name, step down his non-stoppable defense of poor people, black people, minorities, defense against police brutality, all the things that he was known for as a radio journalist all through the Philadelphia and surrounding areas at the time. So you asked the question about Mumia being a political prisoner, and from my political view, I call him more than a political prisoner, because you can say, like, you know, there's calling the January 6th people political prisoners. Well, Mumia is a class war prisoner, meaning that he's always been a defender of the interests of working people of all color, of all ethnicities, you know, all religions and everything like that. And everything he's done is to stand up for right against people who are working people, people who are oppressed and repressed in this society, and fighting on their behalf in every possible way that he can to change the system that we have. So that's my description of Mumia. I've known him since I started corresponding with him in February 1987, a few years after he was imprisoned falsely, convicted for the murder of Officer Faulkner and sentenced to death on death row. I first visited him in Huntington Prison
in central Philadelphia when he was not only on death row, this was in August of 1987, and he was not only on death row, but he was in the disciplinary section of death row, where he was locked up in, 24/7 on a cell block with a lot of people who were also very disturbed and emotional. And it was a very, very hard place. He couldn't have any books. I brought him some books to have. He wasn't allowed to have any books at that time. He had no TV. He had no radio. He had only a few books that were available there, and all because not only because of who he was, but he wouldn't cut his dreadlocks, which they considered to be a security violation. And that was my first meeting with Mumia, talking about why he was there, what was going on, you know, why he was in this situation. And he maintained that, he was innocent. And he didn't have any reason that he needed to explain that to people, given his whole history and who he was and what he stood for and what his activities have been, was at the time. That he was, they had the burden of proof, he said. Why, I shouldn't have to explain to these courts and succumb to the brutality that's in there and the outrageousness of Judge Albert Szabo, who was known as a hanging judge. He basically had sentenced more people to death out of the Philadelphia court that Mumia was tried in than any other judge in the country. And Mumia had always stood up for that. So it was my first meeting with him way back in 1987, the summer of 1987. And then I began assisting Mumia in various pro se, proceedings and filings that he had, and assisted him in getting new counsel to represent him in what would have to be another challenge to his conviction. He had already had his first appeal, and his death sentence was upheld by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And I was working at the time with a group called the Partisan Defense Committee, and we began a political campaign for Mumia, demanding that the death penalty, be stopped, and, carried out a campaign discussing the fact that the death penalty was, in the United States, was a racist legal lynching, a legalized form of old school Southern racist lynching. And that's what Mumia's case was about, and began spreading evidence of the falsity of the case against Mumia, as well as helping to mobilize people around the world to begin to organize and protest to stop Mumia from being executed, and making the arguments about the need for his freedom from everything.
Can you talk about his innocence in the case? Can you talk about some of the lawfare that the government waged against Mumia during his trial, and some of the things that the government is doing that is abnormal in a legal sense?
Well, I want to say this first. Mumia's case is both totally unique, even in the midst of all the political prisoners that existed in the United States and the other Panthers who were in prison and in prison at the time that Mumia was convicted. But also it's unique because of the amount of influence that the Fraternal Order of Police has across the country in demanding that Mumia be not subjected to capital punishment, but then to be kept in prison for his entire life. And at the same time, the things that happened to Mumia happened to him, not only to him. His case also is representative of really the type of legal treatment in its totality that most prisoners, most people arrested, get subjected to in one way or another: falsification of evidence, coercion of people to become witnesses against people, not abiding by, the basic constitutional rights of a jury of one's peers about not falsifying evidence and all that. In Mumia's case, all these different violations of what is supposed to be the law and the actual framing up process of the police in this country, which is a frame up system to begin with. You don't have to be Mumia to be framed up by the cops or by the prosecutor. But in Mumia's case, the virulence, the insistence that he remain now in prison for the entirety of his life and that all his appeals be denied for one bogus reason after another is because they want to keep Mumia silent. They want to silence him. They want to punish him for the fact that he is who he is and he's maintained how outspoken he is about all the things that are wrong about what the U.S. government has done, both internally as well as across the world, from, you know, the question of police brutality and violations of people's rights in the courts and the inequities of the system, and whether it's medical care and police processes and judicial, but also internationally. I think people are probably aware of his statements about the genocide in Gaza. And he's been outspoken across these decades he's been in prison about similar types of actions by the U.S. government way back to the Iraq War, et cetera, et cetera. So in any event, I would call it, and I know that you've probably heard this from Mumia's son, there's not a Mumia exception so much, which a lot of people talk about, is that he's being treated so differently than everybody else, but rather a Mumia rule, that they've used Mumia's case from the time he was convicted, and he was convicted on the false grounds that he literally sort of executed this cop by standing over him and pointing a gun face down at him and shooting him in that way, to basically use his case and the fact that the entire system really ganged up to convict him and sentence him to death, to use it as a basis to become precedent every time he fights for something to sort of make the law apply to him. How do you deal with having a new witness? And how do you deal with all the question of jury selection and the lack of falsification of ballistics and everything, to use the laws, the decisions that come denying him the rights that he's entitled to from the proof that he's shown, is a way to basically make law that actually makes it impossible for other people to get those benefits as well. They use his case as precedent-making in the most negative way, and that's because of the virulence of the state against Mumia. So in terms of the evidence of innocence, so I would just ask people to think about the following things I'm going to raise as issues, and hopefully you'll get a chance to hear me and Mumia's firstborn son, Jamal, speak as well at times in the Bay Area. And so I'll say this, how many people out there know that there is a man that confessed to actually doing the shooting of Faulkner? How many people know about that? How many people understand and have the information that who was involved in the frame-up of Mumia, because it is a frame-up, how many people know that there were like some 30 cops on the scene at the time that Mumia was arrested, that the third in command in the Philadelphia police thing was on the scene within 30 seconds of the time of the shooting? And he was the person who single-handedly, you know, falsified the fact that Mumia's gun was the murder weapon. And Mumia had a gun because he was driving a cab at that time, and he had been robbed or attempted to be robbed. He had a registered lawful gun at the time. And Inspector Giordano, his name is Giordano, third in command in the Philadelphia Police Force. He was the best buddy of Frank Rizzo, the notorious police chief, and then the mayor of Philadelphia. And he also invented witness, a cab driver, saying that the cab driver saw Mumia commit the shooting. That cab driver was nowhere near the spot that he said he was. His cab wasn't parked where the police said he was parked. The woman that they said identified Mumia, also a prostitute working in that area, she actually was really beholden to the cops. She, you know, did a lot of tricks with the cops. She owed her life on the street to them. People know about the fact that there's no proof, despite what the cops say, that the bullet that shot Faulkner came from Mumia's gun or could have been shot from Mumia's gun. They say that they didn't do any testing of his hands to see whether there was any sign of gunpowder on them, only that's not true either. They deny, as people know, there was another witnesses that did not testify, not allowed to testify at the trial, who describes Mumia being beaten by a dozen cops on the scene. Mumia was actually shot. People may not know this, but he was shot by a cop, not necessarily, and I don't think it was the cop Faulkner who stopped Mumia, but actually another cop who was there waiting on the scene to see what was going to happen that night, and that Mumia was shot critically wounded. He was shot in a downward motion, and it actually went through his main organs. He was only critically wounded, in addition to being wounded. the cops say, and they said at the trial that Mumia had confessed, and they said that he had confessed first by this Giordano guy, this chief inspector, who actually came into the van where they had thrown Mumia after they'd beaten him up. Giordano beat him some more. Giordano said that Mumia confessed, and Giordano never testified at the trial. And one would have to ask why he didn't testify again at the trial. And that's a whole other story. It has to do with the fact that those cops were all under investigation, including the chief command in the chain of command and the people in the precinct in the area where Mumia was arrested. They were under investigation by the federal government, the FBI, for corruption. And not only corruption, but corruption in league with the mob. There were three parallel investigations going on at the time. I'm sure most people who believe they know something about Mumia's case do not know these facts of the case, and that there is a reasonable suspicion that Faulkner was actually a snitch for the feds rather at that time. And basically the cops and the mob were not happy with that. They were very nervous about there being an undercover agent in the 6th District where this happened. In the end, this guy Giordano did not testify at the trial. That's who Mumia thought was going to testify and say that he had confessed on the scene. And you know what the cop was going to say? He's going to say, Mumia said to me, oh, the gun is there by the car where in the sidewalk where I threw it after I killed the motherfucker. I mean, really, you know, Mumia was going to say something like that. So he said, but that's what Mumia thought was going to come out at the trial. And he was going to handle that. And instead of that, Giordano was no place to be found. And at the very last minute, as Mumia is beginning his trial for his life, what happens is they come up with the idea, or they say that there were two cops that had heard Mumia confess, separate from Giordano, the cops that took him in the van to the hospital, and then also at the hospital where he was beaten again by cops, that these guys all heard Mumia also confess there. And we learned later on that these whole things of confessions that were supposedly presented, so it was like 60 days after the shooting. Cops who were on the scene supposedly didn't remember or too stunned to tell when they were interviewed the night of the shooting that they had heard this confession. So this was totally invented. And we learned through investigation that the reason why Giordano didn't testify is because he was removed from his position as being third in the command and inspector sometime in February, a couple of months after the shooting. And at that point, what happened is he was put in the personnel division as a desk job. He retired the day after Mumia was sentenced to death. And then we learned that Giordano, who had been under investigation himself at the time of shooting of Faulkner under these federal corruption cases and everything like that. And I have every reason to believe that the reason why Giordano did not testify, they did not put him on, is because the feds who were doing the investigation said, you're going to really mess up our case, meaning their federal investigation, and you're going to mess up the conviction if you put this guy Giordano on the stand during the time of Mumia's trial, when it's going to come out that he was basically under investigation for corruption at the time. So these are just part of some of the stories. So that the idea that the police and the prosecution had at Mumia's trial is that there were two witnesses, at least, that saw Mumia do the shooting. Not true. That Mumia's gun had to be the murder weapon. Not true. There was no proof of that whatsoever. And that also there was this confession, which was not true.
That was former attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rachel Wilkestein, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. Mumia Week is coming up on April 21st through the 25th. More information on the tour is available on Instagram at Mumia Freedom Tour.
Come on. I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, killing, he's a hero. Get it. To the kids, who the hell cares? One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship them, don't let them deal with brothers. Give them guns, step back, watch them kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brothers, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. come on, come on. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is.
That was the legendary Tupac Shakur, Changes. Last week, high-profile podcaster and Elon Musk protege, Mario Nafal, posted an interview with Rwanda President Paul Kagame to his ex-social media platform. He greatly flattered Kagame and excused his ongoing war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And Garrison commented on X, and his production team then invited her to record this response.
So first, Mario Nafal, thanks for giving me a chance to respond. My main problem with your investigation is that your only source is the Rwandan president. You repeat his talking points, then invite him to elaborate without challenge. Why are Kagame's statements true? Because he's the president and he says they are. Kagame says his troops aren't in Congo, but Rwandan troops have invaded Congo over and over since 1996, in indisputable violation of the UN Charter. The first principle of international law is that no nation can send its troops across another's border without invitation. Rwanda is an invading and occupying power, and this is documented in decades of UN reports. News reports often say that Rwanda is, quote, supporting the M23 militia, unquote, who are Congolese. But the UN investigators' June and December 2024 reports say that there are even more Rwandan troops than M23 in DRC, and that they're integrated and operating under Rwandan command. On February 21st, the UN Security Council unanimously passed a resolution demanding that Rwandan defense forces withdraw from DRC. Rwanda has been looting Congolese resources for the past 30 years. This is well documented in UN Group of Experts reports on the illegal resource traffic 2001, 2002, 2003, and biannual reports published since. The 2001 report said that Rwanda had set up a Congo desk to manage various aspects of the resource traffic, including sale on international markets. In December 2024, UN investigators reported that M23 had conquered Rubaya, site of 15% of the world's coltan. They said that at least 150 tons of coltan had since been smuggled out to Rwanda. Back in January 2008, the International Rescue Committee reported that since Rwanda and Uganda's 1998 invasion of Congo, 5.4 million people had died as a consequence, mostly from displacement and disease. Nearly half were children. No one has produced such a study since, but the number is no doubt much higher. By November 2024, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reported that the internally displaced population had swollen to nearly 7 million, mostly in the provinces neighboring Rwanda and Uganda. Rwanda angrily dismisses the findings of all the UN human rights and investigative staff. I had firsthand experience of this in 2010, when I attended a conference on genocide here at Sacramento State University. At a small breakout session, I raised my hand to suggest that anyone evaluating the Rwandan genocide and its aftermath in DRC should consider 16 years of UN investigations, including the UN mapping report on human rights abuse in DRC, which had just been published. Before I could finish the sentence, the Rwandan moderator interrupted me, outraged. How dare I mention these reports? He told me I would not be allowed to say one more word, and then it got worse. Around 10 of Kagame's people surrounded me, screaming. Then one actually grabbed hold of me before a university authority intervened. I filed an assault complaint, which is still on the records of the Sacramento State Campus Police. I tell this story to demonstrate what a threat the UN investigations are to the Kagame regime. Such a threat that I was actually assaulted just for mentioning them in a room of fewer than 30 people at a small state university. Now, the last thing I'm going to say is probably the most important. The 30-year war in Congo never would have happened if there weren't willing buyers for all the stolen minerals. The UN mapping report said that there was never any shortage of foreign buyers and that they included multinationals. What has happened in Congo is a genocide against Congolese people. Millions have died, not because of who they are, but because of what they have. Gold, coltan, tin, tungsten, and most every mineral essential to electronics, auto, and weapons manufacture. You can find hot links to all the studies and reports I've mentioned in my recent work in Black Agenda Report, blackagendareport.com, and The Gray Zone, thegrayzone.com. Peace out.
That was Pacifica's Ann Garrison responding to podcaster Mario Nafal's interview with Rwandan President Paul Kagame. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. In honor of Women's History Month, Pacifica's WPFW producer host of What's at Stake and CRD contributor Fahima Sack remembers the extraordinary contributions of scholar activist Dr. Andre Nicola McLaughlin, born on February 12, 1948, and she transitioned December 4, 2024. Here's Fahima Sack in conversation with Dr. McLaughlin's sister, Joanne McLaughlin, and Professor Director Emeritus Sophia Bandelli of the Center for Women's Studies at Megar Evers College, New York City.
And we're going to talk a little bit about her time at Cornell University, because I know she was part of the Willard Straight Hall student takeover. Okay, so she went off to college, and this was during a very intense time in society. What was your parents' reaction to the transformation of Andre when she went off to college?
Well, you know, Andre would come back with straight A's, so they were pleased with that. With the afro, they were a little taken aback when she came back with the giant afro. But Andre always worked within the community, because during that time, it was a tense time in the 70s. The city of White Plains constructed and, you know, started their urban renewal program, and it shut down many Black businesses in the outlying Black communities. And young Black students at the public schools were having some type of racial strife, and they wanted Black studies in their school. And Andre, when she would come home, she would work with the local churches, and she helped develop a Black history curriculum for the freedom schools. And we had freedom schools back there in the 70s, which I think we should implement again, personally. But my parents, you know, they kind of went, they were very proud of Andre. You know, they were just, you know, they were learning themselves. You know, everybody was going through this transition, you know, what was happening in the United States.
Sophia, I know that Dr. McLaughlin was a professor and a dean at Megar Evers College and one of your colleagues. Share with those in the listening audience what it was like and how you first met Dr. McLaughlin.
Well, Dr. McLaughlin actually hired me November 1977. I was working with a community organization called the Sisterhood of Black Single Mothers. And Andre had heard about it and had referred Medgar students to our organization, those who were single, to get support. So when I lost my job, my PR job right out of college, Andre hired me as academic advisor in what was then the humanities department. And my job was to academically advise, but also because the student population was predominantly women and more than 75% women and 90% women of African descent. So she hired me. She was the dean. She was chair of a program. So she had that authority to hire me as an academic advisor, November 1977, for which I will be eternally grateful. Her tenure at Medgar, the most, I say, a woman ahead of her time. They do feminist studies today, but what Andre McLaughlin did was so far ahead of her time. Interdisciplinary studies, Black women in madness, Black women in self, all of these things that we did at that small college. And I was so proud to be a part of that. I taught a course called Black Women in the Self, which was great. It was just really, really groundbreaking stuff. But most importantly, she used her savvy, her and her love to help steer people into the tenure track. She would guide people who had wanted to get tenure. This is what you do. This is how you do it. This is the strategy. This is how you get support. Because, you know, the academy, the ivory tower can be cutthroat. So you need somebody who really knows how to navigate that system. And she knew how to navigate that system as a dean, as a chair, as a teacher, as an administrator, just as a person with an international and a love for people, love for Black people in particular, steered her and steered us. So her it was a great time at Medgar when Andre was there doing her magic and helping all of us to get tenure and to get through and to be strategic, but most of all to, you know, just to really to stand up for what was right.
I know that she was on the right side of justice.
Absolutely.
When the takeover Absolutely. Took place. Can you share with Yes. those in our listening audience what that was about and what that was like?
Yeah, you know, somebody is talking about doing a documentary, and they should. It was 1982, 1981. And the students were just getting increasingly disenchanted with the college administration in terms of support for students. That was the main thing. There was certainly no childcare at that time. There was no Black studies. I mean, it was not a good place in terms of learning. And so the students said, you know, we're going to strike. We're going to take over the president's office until something happens. I think it was 100 and some days to take over. The students, when the president left, we just occupied his office, his posh office. We sat in there. And later, of course, it became the Child Care Center, which is such poetic justice. That became the Child Care Center, the Ella Baker Charles Romain Child Care Center. But we were in there 110 days. Our demands, you know, included Black studies. We didn't get that. A women's center. We got that. Counseling and other things. It was like really non-hierarchical because the students were as valuable and as important as the community members, as the staff, as the faculty. It really was a great sit-in in terms of how people organize and get things done. And it was, like I said, 110 days. It was kind of scary because they were threatening, CUNY was threatening, they send the police and do this and do that. But we stood our ground. We stood our ground. And she was a strategic person in that, you know, in terms of writing up a lot of the things. We would talk about that, what the demands should be, and then just other principled positions. But mainly we insisted that it was the students, staff, faculty, community. And each area was important, each cohort, students, staff, faculty, community, each as important as the other. And that was unique about that. We didn't really separate ourselves from the community in that way. In fact, when the Women's Center opened, our policy was that we would work with women in the community. It was like, wow, you're a student service. What, you know, no, we're student service and we help women and families from the community. And we were able to do that just by standing firm. And in terms of standing firm, you can't have a better example of standing firm than Andre McLaughlin. She was that. She was that. Yeah.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio. I'm Fahima Sek. And today we give tribute and honor to Dr. Andre Nicola McLaughlin, professor, writer, scholar, activist. She was the holder of the Dr. Betty Shabazz Distinguished Chair for Social Justice, and she was also the international coordinator for the International Black Women's Cross-Cultural Studies Institute. So many of those international relationships that Dr. McLaughlin built over the years developed a robust institute. Sophia, you were in Durban, South Africa. You didn't necessarily travel with the Institute, but you were in South Africa for the UN Conference Against Racism. And I know you had arranged some interviews as I was doing interviews as well for Dr. McLaughlin. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about that experience? Because a lot has come out of the UN Conference Against Racism.
Right. Well, the interviews and the work that we did was just in keeping with the theme of the conference. It's what is the status of the people? What is being done regarding the status of the people? And it was that, you know, that kind of reaffirmation that we over here are not crazy in thinking that this is, you know, racial supremacy, whatever, that we're not crazy. This is like a worldwide kind of thing. But interesting, I don't know if we went together to Nairobi. But I don't know if the Institute went to Nairobi for the women's conference.
I know there was a women's conference.
And Andre was there. Then I remember prepping for that with her about, and just to be in that space with the women who were like, well, you know, we can really make the world a better place. But, you know, and I'll tell this anecdote from Durban, which was so striking. The hotel that I was in, I was going out one night, and I must have been by myself walking out. So when I walked out my room, went through the lobby, there was a red carpet down. So I'm just going to exit. So I start walking down the red carpet to exit. And the two men in the workers started to screaming at me to get off that carpet. This is the VIP carpet. You can't walk on this carpet. I was astonished, but angry. So I said, I am a VIP. And then I walked on the carpet. Their fear that whatever the superior was or whatever, if it was a white or if it's a class thing, was so deep that they were terrified because I, this Black woman with no authority, was walking on the red carpet. So for me, the whole idea that, you know, apartheid and the subservience, you know, yeah, seeped into the psyche so much. So we have, on the one hand, the warriors and the fighters, but then on the other hand, the people who remain cowed under apartheid. Wow. That was in Durban.
The struggle continues. I also recall when we, in, going back to 99, being in Russia for the 200th year anniversary of Alexander Pushkin. I remember it was during a time Bill Clinton was the president at the time, and there was a little ruckus and people were protesting outside of the American embassy. And I said to Dr. McLaughlin, I said, you know, I'm a little concerned. She said, well, look, as long as you keep your mouth shut, they'll think you're from Africa and you won't have nothing to worry about. My guests today are the sister of Dr. Andre Nicola McLaughlin, Joanne McLaughlin, and Professor Sophia Bendelli, who is the Director Emeritus of the Center for Women's Studies at Medgar Evers College of the City University of New York. Dr. Andre Nicola McLaughlin held the Dr. Betty Shabazz Distinguished Chair for Social Justice at Medgar Evers College and was the founder and coordinator of the International Black Women's Cross-Cultural Institute. She was also amongst those students who in 1969 took over Cornell University's Willard Straight Hall, demanding Black studies for subsequent generations, which ushered in Dr. James Turner's Africana Resource Center. She was also my teacher, mentor, and friend, shaping my consciousness and global worldview. Dr. McLaughlin joined the realm of the ancestors on Wednesday, December 4th. It is my hope to convey to my students a fraction of what I received from her. May she rest in power for a job well done. I'm Fahima Sek for Pacifica Radio.
That was music by Sweet Honey and The Rock, I Be Your Water, and that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from J.R. Val Ray, Steve Zeltzer, and Garrison Fihimasek, and myself, Akua Holt. Paulina Basilia is our editor. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.